The U.S. turns off the aid spigot in Syria today, Wednesday, December 11th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. and Britain halt aid shipments to the Syrian rebels, fearing they fall into the wrong hands. Disappointing for the rebels, but this reporter in Damascus says they're used to it.
They have felt let down by the West from the beginning.
Also today, Uruguay legalizes a sale of pot, and consumers are celebrating.
Because they are fed up with buying bad quality marijuana.
Plus, an L.A. musician who gets paid to sing songs about Mexican drug traffickers.
I get all sorts of people that come up to me, oh, I want, can you write a song for me? And who am I to sit there and be like, oh, what do you do for a living? Or can I do a background check?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Wintry weather has caused a lot of disruptions here in the U.S. this week. But imagine dealing with that in the middle of a war. It snowed today in northern Syria and neighboring Lebanon. Bad news for both displaced civilians and rebel fighters. But worse news for the rebels today is the suspension of aid from the U.S. and U.K. That after Islamic militants raided a warehouse where non-lethal aid from the United States was being stored. The militants made off with supplies intended for the more moderate Syrian opposition. The BBC's Lise Doucette is in Damascus. What's been the reaction there, Lise, to this news of the suspension of U.S. and U.K. non-lethal aid?
Well, I can say it's a very smug reaction because basically this has been their narrative from even before there were Islamist groups operating in Syria. They have been saying that they have been fighting, in their words, against armed groups and terrorists. And they have been warning about the rising threat of Islamist groups, including the foreign jihadis, saying that they pose a threat not just to Syria, but to the many, many countries from which they come and to which someday they will return. So I think this has just confirmed the Syrian authorities in their view that ultimately they still believe, and a senior official here very close to President Assad said, they're going to come around to us. They are going to turn course. They just have to find a way to do it, to come back with us, to fight together against what they see is the global threat of terrorism in which Syria is now a principal target.
Should anyone be surprised that this Islamic front took over warehouses where U.S. vehicles and phones and other materiel was stored? I mean, it seems like it was just something waiting to happen.
There has been a general perception confirmed by what we know is happening on the ground in areas controlled by the opposition, that it is the Islamist forces that are prevailing. They're better armed, they're better organized, they're more disciplined. And the formation of the Islamic Front a few weeks ago was seen as a highly significant development, bringing together six or seven of the prominent Islamist groups, although not including the Al-Qaeda-linked groups. And it is this Islamic Front that basically overran both the bases and the warehouses of the Free Syrian Army in northwestern Syria. And that was what set off alarm bells for the United States and for Britain, that the warehouses contained what they describe as non-lethal equipment, that is communications equipment, medical kits, body armor, all the kind of equipment short of arms that they have been providing to the opposition, the moderate opposition, as they call it. Now, Western embassies are saying that this is temporary, it's just a suspension of aid, but it begs the question, when will the Free Syrian Army be strong enough to take back those bases and warehouses, having lost them? This could be a decisive moment because, of course, we all know that the Free Syrian Army has been complaining bitterly about their lack of Western supports. We had reports at one time that they were refusing to eat the MRE, their ready-to-eat meals, because they said it was an insult. And now that the so-called non-lethal aid has been suspended, it then raises the question, what kind of support are they getting from the Western countries who talk about support to the moderate opposition and claiming that it will be a force to be reckoned with in a future Syria? There is a growing reality that the forces to be reckoned with are President Assad's forces and the Islamist forces.
So, Lise, winter is closing in now. It's snowing, actually, in the region. I just saw this heartbreaking picture of Homs in Syria, a completely shell-shocked city, now under snow, really eerie. What's the atmosphere like in Damascus right now?
Heartbreaking if you can be more heartbroken than you have been before the snow came. You know, I looked at those pictures today of the blanket of snow covering, as you say, these shells of houses in homes. I've walked through those neighborhoods, those ghost towns where not a single building is left unmarked by the shrapnel, by the bullet holes, by the aerial bombardment. Nothing lives in those areas. And now they have a pretty blanket of snow on top of it. It is very eerie, but it's also deeply tragic because now Syria has two curses, the war, the continuing war, and the weather. Mother Nature is visiting and we're expecting one of the worst winters in years. And as I speak to you in Damascus, we are expecting the snow to fall here soon. We had heavy rain in some of the suburbs of Damascus, which are besieged. They've been besieged for months, which means food and medical supplies has not been given getting in, where there are reports of people starving. It's just another blow to a country which is already reeling under a growing humanitarian crisis.
Lise, always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The BBC's Lise Doucette in Damascus. If possible, here's more bad news for the Syrian opposition. Activist and human rights lawyer Razan Zeytuneh has reportedly been kidnapped. She was apparently abducted along with her husband and two colleagues from her office outside Damascus. Amr al-Azam knows Razan Zeytuneh. He's a professor at Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio, and a member of the Syrian opposition.
She was the one who still having held on to the idea of peaceful protests and trying to bring about peaceful change. There are very few of those hardy people left, given the situation on the ground in Syria today. Most people like Razan have already left. In fact, many of her own compatriots have either left or have been put in prison by the regime or have been killed. And Razan is one of those last few that are still out there and still trying to do great work and still trying to show that activism in the midst of all this carnage is still possible and viable.
Is it clear, Amr, who kidnapped her?
What we do know is that she was taken from an area under the control of one Zahran Alloush, who's a member of the Islamic Front and very powerful in that area. And we know that, and we believe that it was in this area that is under his control that she was taken from. We also know that there have been serious differences between her and his group, essentially over who controls and how the area is managed, with Razan obviously bringing in her civil activism and civil society movement. And so it's very possible that it was, in fact, very likely. That's what I hear from our people on the ground, that it's very likely that it was Zahran's people who took her.
I mean, but she is also one of these rare remaining members of those early peaceful demonstrations. Could it have been engineered by President Bashar al-Assad?
Of course. I mean, it could have been. And she's been, you know, high up on his wanted list for quite some time. So it's very possible. But the area she was taken from is, you know, technically under opposition control. And as I said, the information that we have right now currently points to Zahran Alloush and his, you know, Salafist group, who are all part of this larger Islamic Front that was recently formed. And we think she's, you know, and because we know that there have been disagreements between them, public disagreements and conflict over, you know, control over the area of that Ghouta. And we know that the people of the Ghouta, the people in that area, this has caused a big, big problem with the locals. And people are now very angry and upset at this. She's very, very popular with the locals because of her activism, because she was actually, you know, working with people on the ground, trying to help better their lives, improve their lives, rather than, you know, what everybody else is doing, which is fighting.
I mean, she seems like a really courageous person. She was underground. Nobody knew where she was hiding, but she was in Damascus. And then when those allegations that we know now of chemical weapons happened outside Damascus, she went out there to report. I mean, what kind of person is she?
You know, she's an incredibly brave woman. You know, consider this. This is a woman, you know, living under the most extreme and extenuating circumstances in where many of us, including close colleagues of hers, have all left or could take no more, if you want, or found a position untenable. She has persisted and stayed on despite the dangers that she faces every day. This is a very rare woman, and I think it will be, if something were to happen to her, it would be a great blow to the opposition. It would be a great blow for Syria. It would be a great blow for the revolution.
Amr al-Azam speaking with us from Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio. Thank you.
Thank you.
This next story draws a line between Paris, France, and the Hopi Nation in Arizona. A collection of Hopi tribal masks went to auction this week in Paris, even though the Hopi had retained a lawyer to stop the sale. The lawyer did not succeed, and yesterday the masks were sold. But there's an interesting twist. The winning bidders now say they'll return the sacred masks due to the Hopi. Pierre Servan-Schreiber is the lawyer who's been working on behalf of the Hopi tribe. In fact, he helped coordinate the bidding.
There were two bidders, actually. One American citizen who asked to remain anonymous, and the Annenberg Foundation. The American bought one of the sacred masks, and the foundation bought every other mask except for one.
So even the auctioneers, I gather, didn't know about the intentions of the buyers.
No, they did not. And they did not know that we were coordinated so as not to bid against one another.
So first, no justice for you because the mask did go to auction, but ultimately a kind of sense of justice. What does this leave you thinking?
It leaves me thinking that it's a very nice outcome for the Hopis, but it's not the end of the story. At some point, there will be the need for a law which will recognize that these kachinas are not to be purchased or sold.
Describe them for us. I mean, why are they so culturally valuable?
First of all, the Hopis never see them as we did in the auction house, naked with a price tag on them. That is extraordinarily offensive for them. They only see them worn by dancers during sacred dances. And of course, they just don't wear a mask. They are entirely covered with paints, bird feathers, eagle feathers, with those kachinas, with pine tree branches, leaves. Why are they so sacred for the Hopis? The legend goes that when going from one world to another, the Hopis believe that humanity has gone through several worlds already. During the last exodus from one world to another, the kachinas, the spirits of the ancestors who were unhappy with the unethical behavior of man, took their children. And the Hopis were very sad to see their children go. So they requested the spirits not to do that again. In exchange of what? They would host sacred dances in which the spirits would be represented by the kachinas. These kachinas are the way the Hopis communicate not only with the spirits of their ancestors, but it's really the communication between the living and the unliving worlds, between what is, what was, and what will be. Mm. It is really, it goes at the heart of their existence.
Wow. So these very meaningful masks, how did they end up in a Paris auction house in the first place?
I think it's very simple. Collectors know that a sale like this would not take place in the U.S. It would be impossible. So they turn to the next large center of arts in the world, which is Paris. I should also mention that the Hopis were described for the first time by Claude Lévi-Strauss, a very well-known anthropologist who had a great admiration for the Hopis.
Right. I mean, there's a kind of fascination with the Native American tribes in France. How'd you feel when the hammer came down yesterday?
When I went to pick up mine, or rather the one that I acquired for this anonymous bidder, I went into the warehouse behind the auction room and I saw almost all of the kachinas all stacked in one rack. And I thought to myself, I know that's the foundation. And they did an excellent job because I think we pretty much bought them all. I was happy about that.
Pierre Servan-Schreiber, a lawyer for the Hopi Indian tribe in Arizona. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, Iran is going to the 2014 World Cup, so why were they upset by the draw? On The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Those are cheers from supporters of legalizing the sale of marijuana in Uruguay after a historic vote last night in the South American country's Senate. That vote made Uruguay the first nation in the world to regulate the production, sale, and consumption of cannabis. I asked the BBC's Ignacio de los Reyes in Montevideo to tell us what that means.
In this country, even though it was legal to smoke marijuana, even in public spaces, the sale and trade of this drug was not. Well, this is about to change. Uruguay will have a complete regulation and will put in the hands of the state every single step of the production, sale, distribution, and consumption of marijuana.
Well, Ignacio, dig in for us into some of the details about this plan. Who gets to sell cannabis and who gets to buy it now?
Well, basically, the state will control every single step, but the state won't produce marijuana. What it will do is it will provide farmers who are interested in growing marijuana with licenses. These producers will grow marijuana that then they will sell it to the state, and the government will distribute this marijuana and will sell it in licensed pharmacies. Then everyone who is registered in a national database will be allowed to buy marijuana in these kind of pharmacies. But for instance, if you'd rather grow your own plants at home, there will be a limit of 6 plants at home or a crop of 500 grams a year. Many consumers actually celebrate and welcome this law because they are fed up with buying bad quality marijuana.
You know, I've been reading some opinion polls that show that 2/3 of Uruguayans don't like this idea. How did it manage to become law?
Because the president, José Mujica, who is a 78-year-old former guerrilla fighter in Uruguay, he's quite a character here, and he's been very popular. And even though this particular law is not that popular, he says that even if it costs him a lot politically, he needs to do that because otherwise Uruguay will end up in the hands of the drug cartels as many other countries in Latin America did before. He says he doesn't want his country to be racked by the violence of the drug trafficking like Mexico, Colombia or Brazil. And therefore, he says, even if it costs him a lot at a political level, this is an experiment that is worth trying because he says Latin America and the U.S. have already tried to fight drug trafficking by law enforcement, by sending more police or even troops to the streets in order to combat the cartels. He says that didn't work in other countries, so why should it work in Uruguay? That's why he's willing to try a different, a new approach.
And finally, Ignacio, I mean, the law was passed yesterday visibly. Did you see anything different today?
It's not going to change from one day to another. It will take months or even a year until we see the first harvest of legal marijuana. What we can see already is that there are a couple of grow shops that have opened in Montevideo that are starting to sell all the cannabis paraphernalia, all the gardening tools and fertilizers and all these kind of tools that are required to grow marijuana at home, which in a couple of months will be a reality here.
Ignacio de los Reyes with the BBC in Montevideo. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
While Uruguay is trying to opt out, Mexico's drug war is still claiming lives. A new documentary puts a spotlight on one musician who makes a living celebrating that violence. It's called Narcocultura. Beto Arcos has the story.
Edgar Quintero was born in Los Angeles, the son of Mexican immigrants. At 28, he's now one of the most successful writers of narcocorridos. His job is to write and sing folk ballads about the drug war.
I sing about it, I talk about it, but to a certain point where I don't get involved. They are my clients. I get all sorts of people that come up to me, oh, I want, can you write a song for me? And who am I to sit there and be like, oh, what do you do for a living? Or can I do a background check?
In the film, Quintero meets up with a client who commissioned a corrido. He sings the song to him inside an SUV.
No me gusta lo corriente, pura calidad en el frasco. Los clientes piden y pagan, y yo les traigo el encargo.
I don't like the cheap stuff, he sings, only pure quality in the jar. The clients ask and pay, and I bring them what they requested. Quintero says when a client commissions a corrido, he asks questions and does research. He says there are certain things that you can say and certain things you can't.
You know, I'm not going to start pointing fingers, and that's when the problems come. That's when singers get killed.
Quintero says he grew up listening to corridos at home in L.A., but they weren't as graphic as they are today. After he started writing his own songs, he was approached by a record label in Culiacán, Mexico, that helped him put together his band, Bucanas de Culiacán. In this scene, the band performs a show in El Paso, and Quintero gets the audience to sing along to one of their hits, with the lines, "With an AK-47 and a bazooka on my shoulder, cross my path and I'll chop your head off. We're bloodthirsty, crazy, and we like to kill." Quintero says he wouldn't want people to think he's glorifying violence. He says he thinks of himself as a reporter of what's happening in Mexico, though some might say he's doing PR for the cartels.
I don't condone violence, but, you know, I have to be real. I have to, the music that I do is, it's hardcore Mexican gangster rap. That's what it is.
Narcocultura also shows another side of the drug war. It tells the parallel story of a crime scene investigator, Ricardo Soto, in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Soto is shown arriving at crime scenes shortly after the bodies fall. He's confronted with the horrors that Quintero sings about. Narcocultura's director is Shaul Schwartz, an Israeli-American photojournalist. He says he gets why Quintero would sing narco corridos. They're popular.
I don't share every view that Edgar shares, where, you know, I'm more angered by it. It's not my cup of tea. He knows that. But with that said, at the end of the day, I understand that the reality created him in the genre, not vice versa.
He says if we don't want the narco culture to thrive, we have to talk about how to start changing it on both sides of the border.
This has a direct effect on our next generation, on people who are not traffickers, who are not gangsters, and this is what I was really after in this film and in this coverage.
Shore says he'd like Americans to understand that it's not just Mexico's war.
There is a vicious cycle, and without the money and without the guns coming from the American side, none of this could exist.
For The World, I'm Beto Arcos.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, an Iranian immigrant switches course in midlife.
I wasn't too happy for what I do. And in life, everyone is good for one thing. And you can do in your life only one thing that you can be the best.
Find out what he does best ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Pope Francis has only been in charge of the Catholic Church since March, but he's made quite an impact in just 9 months. And today, Time magazine honored him as its Person of the Year.
Personally, I think it's a great choice.
Tom Reese is senior analyst for the National Catholic Reporter and a Jesuit priest like Pope Francis.
In a sense, what he's done is he's rebranded Catholicism. I think Harvard Business School is going to be looking at this for years to come. He has changed people's attitude towards the Catholic Church. He has presented the gospel message in a much more positive way. He's emphasized the love, the compassion of Jesus Christ, and he's called on the church to be a reconciler, a community builder, rather than something that's divisive. I mean, it's like suddenly your mother is no longer nagging you, but she's giving you a hug.
If you seem to be suggesting that the rebranding is a positive thing, I think not everybody agrees.
Well, there's always naysayers. But, you know, if you look at the public opinion polls, we've never seen higher rates of, you know, positive attitudes towards the Pope. It's off the charts. Only 4% of Catholics have a negative view of this Pope. Politicians in Washington would kill for these kinds of numbers. It's only the very small, negative, conservative elite, you know, the talk show type folks that are upset because he no longer is making the Catholic Church the, you know, the Republican Party at prayer. He says, no, we've got a bigger agenda.
I gather a small pocket of very liberal Catholics would also have some criticism of the Pope.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's the most liberal and the most conservative who aren't happy. The liberals, most liberals want, you know, they want change and they want now. They want women's ordination now. They want change in the teaching on birth control now. You know, they're unhappy, but I think they're a lot happier with this Pope than they've been with previous popes.
Clearly a shift in tone and emphasis from this new Pope, but what concretely has he changed yet in a way that touches and changes the lives of ordinary people? For example, what about confronting the legacy of child abuse in the church?
Yes, I think, you know, changing the culture of the church is really a substantial change. He's modeling what it means to be a good bishop, a good priest, a good Catholic, to be loving and compassionate. And for victims of sexual abuse, that means getting out in front and telling these people how sad, how sorry the Catholic Church is for what happened to them, and to try and help them in their healing.
I'll bet your thoughts during the eulogies for Nelson Mandela this past week turned a lot to the modeling of this new Pope.
Well, I mean, I think what Nelson Mandela did in the political realm is the same that the Pope is trying to do in the religious realm. Be a reconciler, be a person who brings people together, be a person who talks about issues of justice and reconciliation. This is what the world needs, not the divisive partisan politics that we see in Washington and see around the world.
Tom, let's be blunt for a moment, because Time's Person of the Year magazine cover is a decision that's publicity driven, basically to sell more magazines. Any final thoughts on the Pope being on the same short list as Bashar al-Assad and Miley Cyrus?
Well, I think it shows that he has really had an impact already in just this short amount of time. And frankly, it's not just him. It's the message of Jesus Christ. It's the message of compassion, of love, of concern for the poor that Pope Francis is giving to the world.
Tom Reese with the National Catholic Reporter. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
China is ruled by a communist party that believes in neither God nor religion, but that isn't stopping the Chinese government from trumpeting certain religious beliefs. Last month, Chinese President Xi Jinping went to the hometown of Confucius, and Xi declared that the ideas of the 6th century sage can play a positive role in China's development today. The World's Matthew Bell recently traveled to Nanjing, a prosperous city in eastern China, and he paid a visit to a place that's popular with those seeking assistance from a higher power.
The park around Xuanwu Lake is a tranquil oasis in Nanjing City, a place for a long stroll through the trees or a paddle boat ride with the skyline as a backdrop. There's another well-known spot here. It's a small hilltop shrine built in memory of a Taoist scholar and mystic named Guo Pu. He's a famous writer and fortune teller whose luck ran out when he failed to impress a Chinese warlord with his predictions. The warlord had Guo killed, but a spot where his clothes are said to be buried is now a protected heritage site. At the top of a stone staircase, interpreter Joyce Zhang and I reach the shrine, and we are greeted by a middle-aged guy in big glasses and a simple gray pajama-like outfit. He says he's from Shaolin Temple, one of China's most famous monasteries. And if anyone can explain to me why Chinese people are coming here to seek a little divine intervention, this is my guy. But all he wants to do is foist a pair of cheap wooden bracelets at Joyce and me.
He's a monk?
No,
if he is a monk, he's not a qualified monk.
He's just trying to get money from people?
Yes.
The shrine is surrounded by trees draped in hundreds of red ribbons. They're about 2 feet long, and they've got messages written on them in black magic marker. This is why people come here. They buy a ribbon on sale nearby for about $3 each, write a personal message, and then hang them in the trees near the shrine. Some would call this simple superstition. But many Chinese people would say they believe in some kind of higher power, whether or not they consider themselves religious. We bump into Pan Yuan. She's a 22-year-old who works in a shop, and she's here for the first time.
I just want to come and make a wish, and I heard from my friends that after you hang it in here, oftentimes they come true, so I want to try.
Pan has two wishes written on her red ribbon. One, safety for her parents, and two, business success for her boyfriend. These are pretty common themes, we find out, as Joyce reads what's written on some of the other ribbons hanging nearby.
This one is wishing for their parents to be healthy, and his mother to become more and more pretty, his father to become more and more handsome. Hope my business will boom, and everything will go well and according to my wish. This one is wishing for a woman and her boyfriend or husband to always be together happily.
Most of the ribbons here are apparently hung by women, though we do notice one put up by a man who's looking for a bride, and he's thoughtfully included his phone number on it. The practice seems to have a lot to do with traditional Chinese beliefs that go hand in hand with Taoist and Buddhist practices. But Huang Xiaoying, who describes herself as a Christian, sees her red ribbon wishes as an extension of her own faith. Huang is visiting from out of town. She's a 24-year-old saleswoman for Mary Kay Cosmetics. The bright splash of purple in her hair matches her dress and tights. Huang tells me she's getting married next spring, and her specific wish is for 20 pink cars driven by her colleagues to be part of the motorcade on her wedding day. A pink private car, she explains, is a symbol of success at her company. And seeing that many of them driving through her hometown in honor of her wedding, now that would bring glory to her whole extended family. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Nanjing.
It's an interesting concern for a group like the G8, but today the world's leading industrialized nations committed to an ambitious goal, finding a cure or effective treatment for dementia by 2025. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron at the first ever G8 Dementia Summit in London.
It doesn't matter whether you're in London or Los Angeles, in rural India or in urban Japan, this disease steals lives, it wrecks families, it breaks hearts. And that is why all of us here are so utterly determined to beat it.
Alison Ray has been following the summit closely. She's a professor of linguistics at the Center for Language and Communication at Cardiff University in Wales. And she's been researching language and dementia.
There are some really quite alarming statistics for the amount of dementia there will be in the world in another 20, 30 years' time. One of the things that's been brought out at the G8 summit today is the immense cost to society that's going to bring with a greater number of older people as people are living longer. That's a massive burden on the working population, which would be very hard to cover. That's one of the reasons. The other thing I think we need to recognize that it's not just about a financial pressure. It's about the social impact of dementia on our future social life across the world.
Now, you study dementia through the prism of language. How does that come into play, and what are you trying to figure out?
Well, there are lots of things that one needs to look at in terms of dementia, and clearly one of the most important things is finding out how to prevent it, how to cure it. But there's a whole other side to dementia, which is to do with understanding how we as society can work with people who have dementia to try and make their lives as good as they can be. Language will change in the course of dementia because of the impact of brain damage directly and also because of loss of memory. It makes it more difficult to be able to communicate effectively. And that makes a huge difference to people with dementia. They can't express themselves so well, but they will also lose confidence in their ability to express themselves. And so that will change the way that they interact with people in all sorts of other ways.
So people with dementia, do they forget words or do they lose the ability to construct sentences? What happens?
Well, both of those. A person with dementia will try various ways to compensate for that. And they will draw on the strategies that they've always used all the way through their lives, things that we all do. So when we can't think of a word, we will come up with a little filler expression like, you know, or something like that, and so on, because they want to carry on speaking, because speaking is so important to us as a way of interacting socially.
I was intrigued by something you posted on the G8 Dementia Summit website, which is, you write, a key way to help practitioners, people with dementia, and our wider society break out of entrenched behaviors and attitudes is to understand what works in other cultures and why. So international collaborations are essential. That would imply, Allison, that there's a lot to learn from other cultures when it comes to dementia.
In the US and in Europe, in the UK, we have a particular way in our society of dealing with the idea of dementia. We view our older people in certain kinds of ways, and we are, for all sorts of very understandable ways, very frightened of dementia. Now, clearly there are good reasons for that, but I think we don't always see the extent to which that is partly a cultural choice about how we view dementia. And in other cultures in the world, they don't see older people in that way, and they don't necessarily see dementia as being such a huge problem. It's simply something that you deal with in people if they have it. And so they don't make it into this kind of monster, which is very frightening, which means that you want to push people away or put them into care homes rather than being able to care for them more in the community and so on. And I think we do need to look at some other cultures where they still know how to look after their older people in different ways and see how that impacts on the development and the progression of dementia. One of the things that clearly isn't good for a person with dementia is to sit them in a chair in a care home and not talk to them all day. That's clearly not good, and nobody wants to do that, but it does happen to an awful lot of people, certainly in the UK, and I would guess also in various other Western countries. In some Eastern countries, that wouldn't be the case. And I think we need to look at how that might be impacting on a better experience for people with dementia in those countries.
Allison Ray is a professor of linguistics at the Center of Language and Communication at Cardiff University in Cardiff in Wales. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can hear more of that conversation, including some thoughts on bilingualism and dementia, on our podcast, The World in Words. That's at pri.org/language. The good news, you've got mail. The bad news, you're going to have to walk to pick it up. Not here, but not that far away in Canada. The National Postal Service there is planning to phase out urban home delivery within 5 years. Instead, Canadians will be collecting their mail from community mailboxes. They'll be set up in neighborhoods nationwide. Canadian seniors are not happy. In a country not known for its passionate voices, these reactions from seniors speaking with the CBC qualify as anger.
It's way too far because many seniors have difficulty walking and they would be going out and they wouldn't be safe.
Even I'm a little bit younger, but I'm afraid, especially when it's icy and that, to go out, no? I will miss it, that's for sure.
I get that it's expensive and inconvenient, so I understand the change. Will we cope? Yes. But is it ideal? No.
Canada Post, a government-run corporation, will also be hiking the cost of postage stamps. Buying a single stamp will cost you $1 Canadian, just slightly less than a U.S. dollar right now. And Canada Post also plans to cut 6,000 to 8,000 staff. The changes are to stem the financial losses from consumers switching to, yeah, you guessed it, email. Just don't break the bottle. This is The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Celebrities, you know, often get trolled on social media. Kind of goes with the territory. But Brazilian supermodel Fernanda Lima got more than her share after she hosted last week's draw for the World Cup soccer tournament next year. Lima played a kind of Vanna White-type role, assisting in pulling the names of countries out of a bowl and sorting them into groups. Not very controversial, unless you live in Iran. It's getting a bit complex now, this story. So let's turn to the world's one-man soccer desk, William Troop. What's Iran got to do with all of this, William?
Iran is one of the 32 countries that qualified for next year's World Cup. So they were part of this draw. And naturally, like soccer fans all over the world, fans in Iran were watching live on TV.
Right. And what were they upset by as they watched this draw with Fernanda Lima up there on stage?
Well, in case you weren't watching, Fernanda Lima, who was hosting the event, as you said, was wearing a tight gold dress with a plunging neckline. This was pretty popular with some viewers around the world. There were thousands of positive comments about her dress on Twitter. But in Iran, it was a completely different story because Iranian television does not allow women that are deemed to be dressed immodestly to be shown on television. So every time that the TV cameras during the draw focused on Fernanda Lima, on Iranian TV, the image was dropped. This made for terrible TV viewing for soccer fans in Iran who were waiting to find out who Iran was going to be playing because the show kept getting interrupted.
So are Iranians upset with Fernanda Lima? Are they upset with FIFA for not informing Iranian TV that this was going to be happening?
Well, the hundreds of abusive messages that ended up on Fernanda Lima's Facebook page would suggest that they were upset at her, ranging from, you know, just very insulting comments to suggestions that she should have worn a hijab so that everybody could watch this around the globe.
So I'm just curious, psychologically, with this moment, does this put Iran in an odd position when they get to Brazil next year to play their games?
No, because after the abuse got so bad that Fernanda Lima had to take down her Facebook page, fans from Iran started pouring out online, apologizing for their fellow citizens, saying Iranians are not that way. And that led to even more outpouring from Brazilians online saying, we understand, don't worry, Iranians will be welcome in Brazil.
And Fernanda Lima wasn't the only one who got some of that abuse online.
Oh, yeah. There was the other part of it. In the draw, Iran was put in the same group as Argentina, and that led to same sort of trolling for Leo Messi, the best player in Argentina's team. And again, hundreds of Iranian fans wrote on Messi's Facebook page to apologize. And on top of that, there was even a special Facebook page created by Iranians apologizing to both Messi and Fernanda Lima. That page, by the way, I looked at it today, has more than 40,000 likes now.
Oh, my gosh. All right, people, don't spend all the trash talk at once. Save some of it for next summer's games at the World Cup in Brazil. The World Soccer Desk, William Troop, thank you.
You're welcome.
You can see the dress at outraged Iranian TV viewers at PRI.org. And since we're on the Iran tip, let's end the show today with some Persian comfort food. Asha Reshta is a thick winter soup that you can buy on the street in Iran. In New York, you can get it at Taste of Persia, NYC. It's not really a full restaurant, more like the corner of a pizza joint in Manhattan. As part of our ongoing look at the global tastemakers in the New York area, here's Saeed Purke, who thinks of his Asha Reshta as a lot more than just soup.
I started with Asha Reshta, and I didn't know that Asha Reshta can change my life. Good morning. How are you? I started around 3 o'clock in the morning, and right now is 7:20, and it's almost 5 hours, another hour or two to go, and it takes usually 7 to 8 hours from beginning to end. Can you give me those beans that we cooked? Yeah. Garbanzo, red kidney, and black beans.
White beans, too.
And chickpeas, yeah. Give it to me. Yeah. I came to this country 1 year before the revolution in 1978. And that was my dream to come to the United States. I finished my school and army. I came here and I went to the college, and I knew that I had to start working to make money. I'm going to add this spinach. After spinach, I put my fresh parsley. I used to work in a different printing house in Iran.
My cilantro.
I started doing the same thing here, and I built up a company with my three brothers. Dill and a little bit of parsley flakes, and I use a little bit of tarragon. A few years ago, I decided to change profession because I wasn't too happy for what I do. And in life, everyone is good for one thing. And you can do in your life only one thing that you can be the best. And I think I could do something better.
Somehow, what is better than cinnamon?
And another thing, I use a lot of turmeric. After working for yourself for so many years, you cannot become an employee again. I refused to work, and somehow I ate my investment. I ate all the savings I had. I end up leaving my wife. When I separated, I have no place and I have no money. I got a little bit depression, and it was very, very difficult for me to find out what my passion is. At the age of 55, what else can I do that I don't make a mistake again? And I remember I always loved to cook, and I always cooked for my mom, cooked for my family. I remember this soup from my childhood, from the street of Tehran, when I had a little bit of money, running to the market and have this soup. And I wanted to bring it to New York. That was the first thing I started to present. It was Asheresh. What I do, I saute mint. This linguine has to be cut in 3 to 4 pieces. And I fry the onion to the point that is turning almost golden. That's the time I add the...
You have to add a little bit of salt and pepper.
Yeah.
Let's bring salt and pepper.
And this one, yeah, definitely tastes good. Mm. Yep, it's ready. That was my first idea to start with this complex soup because I believed in it.
Saeed Porkay of Taste of Persia, NYC. He told his story to the world's Alex Galifant. And you can see some pictures of Porkay in action and get a recipe for Asheresh at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org, the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.